Hey, it's Logan Christopher from Legendary Strength, and I'm very happy to be on this call. I haven't done a recorded interview in a while, but once I met Charlie Engel, I knew I absolutely had to bring him on and talk to him because we're going to be talking about physical and mental toughness, and this guy certainly has that in spades. So we'll be talking all about that and really diving into some of the strategies behind it that hopefully you'll find useful and be able to take into your own training and your own life. So if you're not familiar with Charlie, he is a world-renowned ultramarathon runner, having won or placed in some of the planet's most punishing long-distance foot races. In 2007, Matt Damon produced and narrated Running the Sahara, a film about Engel and his team's successful bid to become the first to run 4,500 miles across the Sahara Desert. Yes, running across the Sahara Desert, it's mind-blowing to think about. So I want to welcome you to the call, Charlie.
Oh, thanks, Logan, for having me. I'm excited to join you, and after meeting you in Vermont, I'm intrigued to see where this conversation goes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so I met Charlie just a few months back in Vermont. We were actually out at Joe DeSena of Spartan Races fame on his ranch, and, you know, we got to talking. Obviously, we're both involved in some physical fitness, though very different types of things, but really that element of mental toughness, which is so important, is strong no matter what sort of type of thing you're doing. So to start with, and we're going to dive into those questions in a little bit, but really I think understanding your backstory is important to this. So in a nutshell, without, you know, describing everything, could you tell a little bit about the addiction? Because I feel was definitely a foundation in how you transformed and were able to become this successful in running.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, my story is like most addicts or recovering addicts, there's a lot of complexities, but it comes down to one pretty simple thing. I, in my late teens and 20s, figured out that I was not a good drinker. Or maybe I was a really good drinker. And, you know, my story is, in high school, I was very much an overachiever and you know, captain of the various sports teams and good grades and dated cheerleaders and class president. And I was sort of that guy in high school. And I like to think that I was well liked. And I went to college, as a 17-year-old freshman at UNC Chapel Hill. And, you know, I half expected that there would be a welcome banner on the dorm saying, you know, Charlie, we're so glad you're here. And, of course, that didn't happen. And what I found out pretty quickly was there were 4,000 other freshmen there that also had incredibly good credentials. And, you know, many of them were smarter, better students, better athletes. And I got lost. And at the time, I figured out basically that I was actually good at one thing, and that was drinking. And I began to drink more heavily, and my school suffered, but, you know, I continued to plow through. And without boring you guys with all the gory details, I spent, you know, 12 years battling addiction. And maybe I didn't look like the addict that people might think of. You know, I was still the top salesman at the company I worked for, and I, you know, I got married and bought cars and houses and did things that made me look like a normal person, because I went to great lengths to look as normal as I could, but my addiction continued to grow and my drinking and drug use got worse and worse, and it all culminated in a time when I was 29 years old and just after the birth of my first son. Thought for sure his birth would save me, like he would be my savior and I wouldn't do it anymore. And it's not how addiction works. And I found myself in Wichita, Kansas, where I was working at the time on a job, and watching the police go through my car, and the car had bullet holes in it, and they were put there by somebody who was actually shooting at me, and you know, and it was just a terrible, terrible day, and I made a decision on that day that I needed to change things. It was life or death. And you know, I went to an AA meeting that night, and I got up the next morning and I put on my running shoes, and went for a run, and I did that for 3 straight years. I went to a meeting every day, and I ran every day, and I slowly began to change my life. And quite frankly, I hadn't stopped running since then. You know, that was over 25 years ago at this point. And so I'm very grateful to still be sober today. And it saved, you know, running really saved my life. And then, you know, the rest of my story is that running gave me a life after that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would highly recommend for anyone that wants all those details to check out Charlie's book, Running Man. Very exciting read through those addiction days and then through the addiction to running coming later. And do you feel it really was a case of just switching one addiction for another?
Well, you know, and I yes, in a way. However, and anybody who either is an addict, and look, in this country, in this day and age, everybody either knows an addict, has an addict in their family, has a friend who has a problem with addiction, a parent, a sibling, a son, or maybe you yourself. And, you know, addiction is complicated. And when I was a drug addict and an alcoholic, my goal was to hide. You know, I wanted to be invisible. I didn't want to have feelings at all. And so while I may have switched my habits and even some might say my addiction, you know, running does just the opposite of those things. Running is, there's no hiding in running. You know, running really shines a bright spotlight on who I am. And when I'm in the middle of running 100 miles and things get tough, you know, there's no disappearing or not feeling. I feel everything. And so the beauty of the sport is that I have to be fully present to be successful.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So you started running, and I remember your story if you want to go a little bit into this, but you started doing marathons, and you thought that was the top of it. You had no idea there's this whole realm of ultra marathons, and you accidentally signed up for one. Is that right?
Yeah, which is always I don't know if it's a proud moment for me to admit how stupid I was. Right? You know, it just at the time it just never occurred to me that anybody would run farther than a marathon. I'm like, why would you do that? And people still ask me that question now. But yes, a few years into my running and my sobriety, I had already run about 30 marathons, and you know, I fully expected I was going to be that guy that would, you know, someday be hopefully 80 years old and still running marathons. And, you know, I was happy with that. I went to Australia for a job and entered what I thought was a 5K and, you know, showed up. I had to drive a couple of hours to get to it out in the middle of a rainforest. And I showed up at this race and, you know, people are saying things like, gosh, you know, it's going to be hot today. I sure hope I can finish this race today. And I'm thinking, it's a 5K. You know, either these are the slowest people on earth or they're going to do this. They're going to crawl the 5 kilometers. And somebody finally said to me, so, have you ever run a 50K before? I'm like, no, why? why would I? And you know, I broke into a sweat and, sure enough, I looked down at my own number, and it says, you know, right there, you know, 52K. It's five, you know, it wasn't a 5K, it was a 52K. And again, it is a funny story, and I started this race, and I fully intended to just run. You know, I'd driven a couple of hours to get there, and I wanted the T-shirt, and, you know, I thought I would just run part of the race and quit, and that's what I tried to do. And I was sort of shamed into continuing.
Because you started winning it, right?
Right. And so people were noticing because I was actually in the top five in the race, and I was the only American in the race, the only non-Australian, I think, even. So, you know, it was a couple hundred people, but I stood out just because I was the only Yank, as they called me. And, you know, and so I really, though, not heroically at all, you know, I tried to walk away. I tried to quit the thing. And I finally got about two-thirds of the way through. It was a three-loop race, and I finished the first two loops. And, you know, I'm sunburned and dehydrated, and I got blisters. And I'm just, you know, I came there to run, you know, 3 miles, not 30 miles. And, you know, and something happened to me, though, Logan. I – I guess I realized the moment, and it's not like I had some epiphany or the sun broke through the clouds or something, but, you know, I just said, you know what, I've done two-thirds of this damn thing. Why not just go ahead and finish it? Mm-hmm. And so I did. I did the third loop, and I came around, and I ended up winning the race. And my, you know, the lesson I learned is that, you know, the universe puts you in positions to succeed or fail very often, and a lot of times we take ourselves out of it by default and never even get a genuine result. And this was a lucky time for me where, you know, through the circumstances, I was able to complete this thing and actually do well. And what it taught me was there was a whole lot more to running than just trying to run your fastest marathon, and that I could learn things about myself, the way that I'm built. You know, it's one of those lessons too where, and I say this quite often when I'm giving talks, you know, you don't ever, when you ask somebody to describe the formative things in their life and they go back in time, nobody ever says, oh my gosh, my life was so freaking easy and I didn't have to work for anything and I learned all these great lessons. No, what you hear is, you know, I grew up poor. I got into a car accident. I got cancer. My husband left me. My family just, whatever. You hear about hardship and people say, you know, that really made all the difference, and it forms who we all are. And so through running, what I figured out is I had a voluntary way to put myself into really difficult physical and emotional situations. And I knew that every time I towed the line and I stepped up for a 50-miler or a 100-miler or even a race of hundreds of miles, I was going to learn something new about myself. Not always good, but new.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it definitely seems with that story there's a case of, you know, kind of universal alignment, right? So you don't see the other number in the 5K, so you just imagine that, then these things seem to conspire against you to keep you in that race, which it was kind of like a life-defining moment in many ways.
Totally, and it really did. It you know, sometimes the universe puts you where you need to be, and you just have to pay attention. And we're, you know, a lot of us are so pre-programmed to steer away from, and I mean, you above many people understand this. We steer away from pain and we seek comfort. And I always say comfort is greatly overrated. Nobody ever learned something from the comfortable things. And, you know, I'm not suggesting that, you know, you go, you know, wingsuiting tomorrow and you've never done it before. But, you know, finding a way to do something that's going to be challenging, whether it's in business or physically or personally, emotionally, it's basically the definition of life for me. If you're not doing, if I'm not doing something like that, then it's as if I've given up on trying to grow personally.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So let's fast forward a little bit of time, and you get this wild idea of running across the Sahara Desert. Can you tell that story?
Sounds brilliant, right? And so this idea. So now I've been running for quite a few years, and this takes me up to into the 2000s, and I've been running for quite a while. I've been sober for a while, and I'm in the 2005, and I'm actually in the Amazon jungle in the middle of a 7-day stage race, a running race there. And, you know, and this guy who I really didn't know very well, Canadian guy, we end up being good friends. You know, he, one night after the stage is over, you know, we're laying in these jungle hammocks, and there's mosquitoes and snakes and spiders and everything all over the place. And we're laying there laughing about how filthy we are and how hard this race is. And he's like, hey, I just went to Niger last month to do a race, and the Sahara is really beautiful. He's like, I wonder if anybody's ever run all the way across the Sahara, just like all the way. And I actually set up, if you can sit up in a hammock, I sat up in my hammock and I said, you know, I said, that's quite literally the dumbest idea I've ever heard. It's like, you can't get supplies out there. You know, nobody can run thousands of miles in deep sand. It's just, you know, it's impossible. And that was sort of the end of it, except it wasn't. I couldn't get it out of my head. Like, I just couldn't stop thinking about this idea. And when I got home, I started researching the Sahara Desert, and I found out that, in fact, no one had ever run across the entire length of the Sahara. It turns out for pretty good reason, I guess. But, you know, and I began to tell people that I was going to be the first person to run across the Sahara Desert. I took possession of this idea. And, you know, almost to a person, I was told, you know, that it was impossible. And at this point, I'd done a lot of really hard runs. So I was no longer a novice. And I was certainly a guy that people were used to hearing sort of crazy ideas from. And yet this one seemed so outlandish that even my good friends were like, look, man, you know, it's a bad idea. Don't do it. And finally, a buddy of mine who I was working with, I was a TV producer at the time for Extreme Makeover Home Edition on NBC and ABC. Sorry, oh, they'd shoot me for that. And he was working on the show with me. He's like, so tired of hearing me talk about this idea. He's like, if you'll shut up, I have a director friend of mine who won the Academy Award a few years ago, and if you want, I can set up a meeting and you can go tell him about this crazy idea. And that's what happened. And I got a chance to go meet a guy named James Mall. And frankly, I thought he might introduce me to a student director or, you know, somebody that might be willing to take on this project. And by the time I was done, like, there's a terrible pitch that I gave, one of the worst ever, and yet he stood up at the end of it and extended his hand and said that he wanted to do it. And a week later, this is the funniest part, a week later he calls me and says, you know, look, I just hung up with Matt Damon, and Matt would like to executive produce this film, and he wants to narrate the film too. Would that be okay with you? And I sat in silence for a second, and I quite literally deadpanned. I said, well, James, I was really hoping for somebody better, but sure, Matt Damon would be fine. you know, and so that's how that happened. And, you know, ultimately, flashing forward, you know, after this film is done, you know, Hans Zimmer ended up doing the score. And so I quite literally ended up with three Academy Award winners attached to a running film. And, you know, and a big part of me throughout this process, you know, like practically every day is going, oh my God, I've suckered everybody into this really bad idea. And I have no clue if it's really possible, you know? And so how do I get past this fear? And, you know, and I just kept plowing forward. And I, you know, there we are in Senegal, you know, a year later, and I've got 20 people there, including my two running partners and a whole crew to take care of us and a bunch of film crews and native Tuaregs from the region, from the Sahara, to look after us and make sure we, you know, we don't die. And they're sort of like the Sherpas of the Sahara, kind of. And, you know, and I don't know what to expect. And we embark on this adventure. And, you know, ultimately, a week into this thing, we completely disintegrate. You know, the runners are, there's, you know, three of us running. And we all three, to be clear, are running the entire distance. It's not a relay or anything. You know, we're just running as a team. We're running together. And a week into this thing, it's 125 degrees every day, and ground temperatures are up to like 140 or so, and we're literally melting, I think. And crew members are quitting. My two fellow runners are sick and hooked up to IV bags, and it's just not going well. We got lost a couple times, and I realized, and this is probably the greatest lesson that came from the Sahara, you know, I realized at that moment that I had been so focused on the finish line, on, I've been so focused on success and like envisioning myself putting my feet in the Red Sea, you know, months from that date, that I forgot that I needed to do the hard work on a daily basis. And so I basically the next day, on day number 8, I got up and I said, okay, I'm going to just focus on running a marathon, you know, before lunch. Mm-hmm. And then I'm going to lay down and take a little nap and eat some lunch. And I'm going to get up in the afternoon. I'm going to run another marathon. And that's all I'm going to think about. And then that night I'm going to lay my little foam mat out and I'm going to stare up at the stars and be grateful that I'm actually out there alive and suffering. And then I'm going to get up the next day and do it again. And slowly but surely in this way, you know, we began to make our way across this desert. And 111 days later, we reached the Red Sea, and we had run nearly 50 miles per day for 111 consecutive days without taking a single day off. And, you know, it was, needless to say, a life-changing and life-transforming experience, and one that I will, you know, I will never forget. And just one more thing about the Sahara, and I think this is another, you know, hopefully there's a lot of people out there that can relate to this. There was this huge project that I had taken on, and I also co-founded with Matt Damon a water nonprofit and to provide clean water infrastructure in Africa, and it was called H2O Africa. And today that nonprofit has turned into water.org, and Matt is still involved, and a lot of people see the ads for water.org these days. And you know, it's a very proud thing for me to know that by doing something that I was passionate about, which basically was running and telling a story, by doing that, it created the atmosphere that allowed for a much bigger and more important thing, you know, to happen. And that was that, you know, literally today, millions of lives are affected by having clean water that they didn't have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great, and it actually kind of segues to some of my next questions, because I really want to dive into the values that drive you, that keep you running when you hit those really hard moments. And you've certainly talked a little bit about some of those things, but I want to read a few quotes from your book back to you and just kind of get you to expound on them, or some questions that derive from them. So it seems one of the big things for you and why you enjoy running is this chasing this feeling that you have. For example, you said, "I ached for that exquisite, illuminating pain now, the kind that exposes who you really are and asks you who you want to be." Can you expound on that?
Yeah, I can. It's a great, thank you for that quote, because that's, it is, you know, and I recognize that part of it is related to my addict. And just to take one quick step back, you know, I spent the first few years of my running and my sobriety thinking that I needed to kill my addict. I needed to pound that part of my personality out of me. And it took me years to really appreciate and to understand that, in fact, my addictive nature is what makes me good at things. It's you know, it's the actions that I took as an addict, not the underlying addiction, that actually caused my problems. And so consequently, I figured out that I could harness my addictive nature and my drive that gives me to, you know, to accomplish some things that I may not have been able to do otherwise. And so the lesson that I learned is that I like to push myself to that place physically and emotionally where I want to quit, like where I hit that spot where I'm like, look, I've had enough. And then dig in and try to find a way to just hang in there a little bit longer and push past that moment. Because, you know, most of us, I say this to recovering addicts all the time, especially people who are new in sobriety, you know, and I think it translates well to life. I think we all spend, you know, 99.5% of our time basically in this moderately safe middle ground, you know, with some highs and lows, but generally speaking, you know, we're sort of trudging along, living our lives and hopefully having some good experiences, some bad ones. But what we're really preparing for is that other half a percent, that 0.5% when everything goes to hell. Because it's my experience that, you know, who we really are is really defined and is illuminated by the times when everything goes to hell, when everything falls apart. And so I want to feel that pain. And yes, I do mean sort of, you know, the physical pain that might come with running or biking or climbing or some of the things that I do. Yes, but what that really does is that provides the mechanism for scraping away all the, like, crap that we accumulate in daily life and puts me in a place where my mind is clear and I can just have the experience without all the noise that surrounds it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think it was earlier in your book you mentioned, I knew that I deserved the pain. Running was my penance. So that was kind of that earlier phase when you were kind of beating, what do you say, pounding that addictive personality out of yourself versus now you see it in a different light.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, and I felt, look, man, as an addict, I didn't physically hurt people. I didn't, you know, rob a liquor store or whatever, but I mean, I certainly was not I wouldn't consider myself a good person during those years in some ways. And I felt guilt about that as anybody, you know, would. And so, you know, I certainly had my underlying, things that made me feel like not a good person. And so part of what I did, especially in those early years of running, was to run and to do these long, difficult things as a way of almost punishing myself to a certain degree. You know, I felt like I deserved that pain. And it, you know, it just took a long time for me to find a balance of, you know, feeling like I was learning something from the experience and no longer, you know, no longer punishing myself for something that wasn't necessarily my fault. You know, I was an addict. I'm still an addict, you know, 25 years clean and sober. The addict still lives inside me. And if I ever chose to go that direction again, then of course, you know, the result would be the same. My life would fall apart.
Mm-hmm. So getting to that feeling more, another quote, I stared at the ceiling, exhausted but too jazzed to sleep. I knew this feeling well. I was scraped clean, made new, fully open. People asked me why I ran. I wish I could let them feel this way for just a few minutes. Then they would know. I love this feeling of being raw more than anything else. Is there, I mean, at what point do you get to this feeling? Is it really the continual pushing of the limits? Do you get this feeling after, like, every run you go to or every race that you do?
Man. That's a tough one, but you know, people, I always remember that, you know, through my whole life, people have said, like, yeah, so what, tell me about the runner's high. I'm like, oh, I have no idea what you're talking about. Because, you know, yes, maybe on a couple of occasions, I got a second wind in the middle of a run and I felt good and was able to push, but usually that endorphin release doesn't happen until long after the run is over. I'm like, if there's a runner's high, it's because I'm really happy to be finished, you know, yeah. as much as anything. But to your question, you know, I do believe, and this is how I envision it. You know, I do envision that as I'm running, if I'm just going to go out for a, let's just say for a 20-mile run, and a lot of people
just a casual 20-mile run.
But, you know, a lot of people who train for, you know, mm-hmm. let's even say a 10-mile run, something that maybe, you know, a whole lot of people can relate to. It takes the first couple of miles before I stop thinking about the phone call I needed to make, the email I needed to return, the, you know, whatever argument I had with the gas station attendant. I don't think that really happens, but, you know, whatever, just all the stuff that accumulates for all of us just by, you know, existing on a daily basis. So when I go out to run, you know, it's almost like I'm wearing, you know, 10 shirts, and one by one I start peeling those off, you know, and my brain starts to settle down and I feel my breathing become rhythmic, and I do like envision it almost like a, you know, a skin being scraped clean, like skin of an animal, and that the whole purpose is to create this new clean place where more and better stuff can be put. And for me, that's how I envision my running. I guess one other visual that I like is, you know, if you've ever gone swimming in a pond or had to take a, you know, needed to take a drink, you know, you kind of got to scrape away the, you know, there's a bunch of crap floating on top, and you have to sort of move that out of the way, and you reach down to the cooler, cleaner water that's down below the surface, and that's what you're trying to get to. So my purpose when I, not just running, but I do meditation, I do yoga, I do some other things that I don't always need to, like, physically beat myself up to get to that place anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, the fastest way for me to get there is to put on my shoes and head out the door and you know, and start putting in some miles.
Okay. Yeah, I was just going to comment that it sounds very meditative, what you're doing there. So I'm curious to get more, because you're saying this visual of wearing the 10 shirts and peeling them off or scraping clean, there's a very much a feeling component to this. And you mentioned that after a few miles you'd clear your head or thoughts. Is there anything else that really kind of the essence of that feeling, that state that you get to, whether it's through running or these other means, that you could describe?
Well, so yes, you know, so the meditation and yoga certainly is a thing that I've learned in recent years that gets me to some of the same places. But I think that I'm not really going to answer your question with this answer, but I'm going to be like a politician and give you the answer I want to get. you know, one of the things my wife pointed out to me, and we've been married 4 years tomorrow, in fact, is that I am very, very good. Like when the chips are down, if things go to hell, Logan, you want me in your corner, you know? You want me there because I don't panic when things go wrong, and I almost thrive on hardship, and I like that challenge and what it feels like, and you know, I want to find a solution and a way to get through, you know, whatever it is. But when things are just okay and life is actually pretty good and there's no major catastrophes on the horizon, you know, I struggle. which sounds funny. So my wife, you know, she asked me a few years back. She's like, you know, you're really good at this whole, you know, struggle thing. And when things are difficult, but do you even have the first clue, you know, how to be happy? And my answer honestly was no. You know, like I really struggle with this place of just being content. And I think there's, you know, at this point in my life, I'm still seeking balance. I don't have all the answers.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm trying to do is find a way to be balanced and to be satisfied and content. Not necessarily that I'm going to stop doing the things that I'm doing, but when things are okay, don't create chaos just so I have a problem to solve. You know, and so part of my way of living these days is to find ways to be peaceful and quiet, go for a walk instead of a run sometimes, go outside, and my wife is actually a scientist. She's an ornithologist, a bird expert. And so, you know, go outside with her and listen to nature and try to just be instead of always needing something to do. Try to just exist sometimes, and that's a struggle for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the other quotes from your book, right on this: as hard as it was to admit, a part of me missed something about those attic days. Not the drugs themselves, but the pulse-jacking danger of that life. Knowing that every day I could be teetering on the edge of a rusted blade, I felt happiest and most alive when I was in peril.
Yeah, that was me, and it is still me.
Yeah,
it's a great. I'm glad you picked that one too, because it's crazy, and people think I'm nuts when I say this, but you know, driving into a strange neighborhood to buy drugs and experiencing that danger and exhilaration. I'm not saying that I want to feel that, but there were parts of that feeling at the time, all those years ago, that were very, it was very exciting and dangerous and stupid. And I'm not in any way trying to romanticize what I was doing, but you know, quite bluntly, I worried when I got sober that my life was just going to be freaking boring.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Because, you know, I don't know. I'd just gotten used to all that. And so I do. I still love this idea of going into something like running across the Sahara Desert. I was so over my head. I mean, I had no idea what we were going to face.
Right.
You know?
You could say the same things off of that. It was stupid. It was dangerous. Like, it really is very much the same.
Absolutely. But if you also think about this, and I do remind, you know, quote unquote normal people, I don't know if anybody's normal or maybe not the people I know, but you know, it's a crazy undertaking to think about, you know, having a kid or starting a business or like, these are scary things, right? I mean, because if you've never done it before, and even if you have, you anticipate all the things that might go wrong. It's easier to just not do it in some ways and not ever take a risk or a chance. But geez, I certainly don't want to live that way. You know, I want to live in a way that hopefully balances some risk taking, with progress, you know, with making progress as a human being, but also, you know, with finding new challenges and finding something else that's going to, you know, turn me on. I don't want to wake up and think about going to do something that, I mean, sure, I have to do certain things that I'm just doing it because I need to get paid. You know, I need to make a living, but I'm hoping that that will never be the only reason I'm doing something.
Right. So I'd like to focus now on pain and relationship to pain. First of all, this is a big question and one that I have, you know, spent a lot of time thinking about myself. What is the difference between, like, the pain of injury? Because I know you've had races where you did have to stop. And then the pain of discomfort, like, you know, running a marathon. It's not a comfortable thing to do. So do you have any thoughts as to the line between those and being able to differentiate them? Because people will often, you know, oh, it's painful to go running, but that's really just laziness versus mm-hmm. painful that, you know, if someone had a bad knee and that would make it much worse. These are two very different things. So your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a great, it's a complicated question
yeah.
because, you know, I can only know what physical pain feels like for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, none of us can actually, despite the fact that we can witness someone else's physical pain, you know, we can't compare our pain to theirs because we don't know what it feels like. Now, obviously, if somebody's got a, you know, a broken leg and it's dangling at a 90-degree angle, it's pretty clear that that's probably painful and that they need to not run on that.
Yeah.
But it is, you know, what I tell people with regards to running, when it's this, first of all, most people that start running after maybe many years of not running, it hurts. It's uncomfortable. And look, running is a universal thing. We all ran, and as kids, we are runners. I mean, we all are. I mean, if you're capable physically, assuming there's no impediment to running, you know, we all run because we want to get where we're going as fast as we can get there. We're excited. We want to go to our friend's house. We want to, it doesn't matter. You just want to go across the living room as fast as you can when you're a kid. And when we get older and maybe it's been 20 years and you haven't run and you go out the door and you've got this awesome plan of how you're going to get in shape and lose weight and this is it, you know, and you mean it. Everything in your heart means it. But you go out there and you take off at a breakneck pace and guess what? You know, 300 yards into it, you're going, oh my God, this sucks. And you want to quit. And so I think that the important thing is finding a way to moderate that excitement with an approach that allows for growth. When I start people on programs, it's always with a running, walking program, alternating, and you're not allowed to count the miles. You just have to go out there and spend, 20 minutes or 30 minutes or an hour, moving. But injury pain, as it's differentiated between just exertion pain, really does have to be in the in the eye of the person who's experiencing it. And obviously, if a person goes out to run, the other big mistake people make, they start a running program and they're so excited that they go out there and they run every day for the first, 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be like, you're a very strong guy, but you're not going into the gym and bench pressing 10 days in a row, because at least I don't think you are. You might be.
I've done some unusual stuff, but I haven't really done that one.
Right. I mean, and actually, regardless of whatever strength exercise you're doing, I'm assuming you're not going to max out on that strength exercise every single day.
Mm-hmm.
Because it doesn't make sense. You've got to let your body recover. It's a cycle. It recovers and then it gets stronger, and you push it and it recovers and it gets stronger. And that's the idea with this. So any person does have to understand the feeling of true physical pain. Knee injuries, or I should say knee pain, is a great example, because very often a person who hasn't run for a long time, unless they've had a catastrophic knee injury in the past, the knee pain they might be experiencing is probably due to something like an IT band issue, or, something that is just an inherent problem in the leg. As we get older, our tendons and our muscles, they shorten and they get stiffer and tighter. Look at a newborn or a toddler. Man, they bend up like pretzels, right? And the older we get, the less of that most of us are capable of doing. And so it causes, all kinds of different pain for us. And so I know, I realize I'm not exactly answering the question, except for the fact that if a pain is so sharp and there's swelling, there's redness, there's actual visible evidence of an injury, then of course you need to stop and you need to go seek medical treatment. Most of the time it's, my recommendation would be, don't just run, alternate days with an elliptical machine or some cycling and some yoga. And typically what you'll find is that balanced approach will keep you healthy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because a big thing I'm a proponent of is listening to your body. And it's really about understanding, I like that distinction, injury pain versus exertion pain. So hopefully by listening to your body, you can avoid having that seeable injury in the first place. To kind of go a bit further on this point, in running across the Sahara or other long multi-day runs that you've done, I forget the number of days, but you speak about, just the body takes, in like 3 days, you're feeling aches and pains and you're stiff and everything, but at some point you just kind of break through, like your body switches into a new gear and adapts to that running. And is there anything within that kind of clarifies this distinction between types of pain?
Man, totally. And I do tell people that are starting off on a program, I'm like, look, and pardon me for putting it this way, I tend to be blunt. I'm like, look, you didn't get fat in 90 days.
Mm-hmm.
You've been working on this for years. And so you're not magically going to feel fantastic in 90 days. It's not going to just, be simple. And so I should really say you didn't get out of shape in 90 days. That's a fairer way to put it. But so in that first 90 days, there's going to be discomfort. And so I always tell people, no matter what, do not, give this thing 90 days and try to measure how you feel in those first few days against how you feel, towards the end of that 90 days, because I'm certain, actually, I'm so certain that you're going to feel so much better that you will continue doing it. And I think a matter of, you know, it's all a matter of perspective, and it's instinctive, right? And I think that's what you were just saying. You get a program from a coach, or you get it out of a magazine or online or whatever it is you do, but don't be a slave to the numbers on the page when your body is telling you something different. You know, you have to balance determination with instinct. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and finding a way to be instinctive and not be, and but not, you not give yourself a break. You know, the run across the Sahara was a great example, because in the first week, and this is what you were saying, man, we fell apart. Physically, our bodies, I always call it diving into the abyss. You know, we quite literally hit this crazy bottom, all of us did, after a week or 10 days of running. And then magically, it's like the body said, oh, I get it. You're trying to kill me. And, you know, it began to recover, and it adapted to the stress. And I think that's what happens for all of us, no matter what. And we just have to, you know, we got to spend 99% of our time preparing for that 1% when it's all going to suck. And we got to push past that. Usually with running, with long distance running, ultra running, nutrition and hydration plays such a big role that very often it feels like physical depletion, but it's really about calories. And quite often, if I feel terrible at mile 70, well, I've run 70 miles. Of course I'm going to feel lousy. But if I sit down and cram 1,000 calories into my body, pretty magically 20 minutes later, I actually feel better. Mm-hmm. So.
Excellent. So just going a bit further, this relationship to pain, you have some amazing quotes from your book. One of the favorite quotes from the book was this: I was suffering, yes, but this was not the kind of pain I was used to, the kind that implored me to stop. This pain told me to go on, feel the pain, welcome the pain, use the pain, transcend the pain. And the reason I really like that is it's really kind of a strategy for how to use pain, how to go through it through these four different stages. So welcoming it is just really, okay, yes, I'm feeling this pain, hopefully, you know, this exertion pain or pain of discomfort right in that moment, and then going through those. So could you walk through that? And is that something, was that just some great words that came to you when you wrote the book, or is that something you've thought about a lot?
Yeah, man. It is both. Absolutely, it's both. And I think everybody can relate to this, and it does hinge around one simple concept, and that's fear. Because when we're in pain, we actually, whether it's, you know, certainly everyone can relate to it with emotional pain. None of us wants to feel emotional pain. Whatever the source of it is, we want that to stop. And that's just the way, you know, that's natural human instinct, I think. With physical pain, our fear is that it is going to continue. You know, we're running, you know, you're a couple miles into the run and you've planned on running 10 miles, and all of a sudden your mind and your body conspire to start telling you that you can't do this, that the pain is too much and that it's too difficult. And I think it takes a lot of practice, but transcending that pain can be accomplished by a combination of things. And I will freely admit, early on, there was a part of me in the early years that would, you know, almost like yelling to the, you know, I probably looked like a complete lunatic. But, you know, almost like saying, okay, you know, is that all you got? You know, bring it on. Like, I almost was like, I don't know who the hell I was talking to, but it's almost like as if the universe was somehow trying to, like, give me a hard time physically. And you know, it seemed like when I would run, you know, the wind would be in my face both directions. And, you know, it was like, bring it on, you know. And I began to take this attitude of, well, you know what? I'll give you one other example, and I hate to talk in circles, but there's a race that I do every year called Badwater, most years. out in Death Valley, and it's 135 miles through Death Valley in July. And after I did that race the second time, I've done it like seven times. After I did it like the second time, I realized that I felt like there's a lot of hill running. I mean, mountains. You're climbing 5,000 feet, then you're going down 5,000 feet, and you're up 5,000 feet and down 5,000 feet. It's this crazy roller coaster. And what I found was I was a terrible downhill runner, and I told myself I was not a good downhill runner. And I finally got fed up with that, and I spent, you know, 6 months preparing for that race one year. You know, every single day that I trained, I would spend time actually running hill repeats, but I would run hard down the hill and jog back up, which is the opposite of what most people do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, typically you're running hard up and then jogging back down. So I began to tell myself that I was going to be an amazing downhill runner. And I went back to Badwater that year after 6 months of working on running downhill, and I crushed it. I ran 2 hours faster than I'd ever run. You know, I set age group records. I came in third overall in the race. I made a decision that I was going to take a weakness and turn it into a strength. And I think that transcending pain and trying to push that fear aside can only happen through, you know, through hard work and practice. You know, you have to be willing to go out and suffer some.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's good. So it seems most people just kind of default position, because pain is not pleasant. We just typically fear pain. So in this case, you know, just for whatever reason, you weren't good already at downhill. That was something you struggled with. So you got to a point where instead of like, oh, you flipped the switch and decided you were going to become good, you actually practiced that, and that allowed you to eventually transcend the pain of that downhill running.
Yes, no, exactly right. And I mean, again, it you know, and I got the result that I wanted. It doesn't always work out that easily, but and then today, you know, I'm still, what's funny is after doing this for many years, you know, I look for races that are hilly, and I always say, you know, I'm gonna kick ass on the downhill.
Nice. So a little bit that I want to go into is kind of your thinking as you're doing these running. Obviously, when you're running two marathons a day across the Sahara Desert, you have a lot of time to think about all kinds of different things. I'm curious, how much are you, you did mention a little bit of this being like focused on the finish line. Obviously, that's probably more appropriate for shorter races, whereas the Sahara being focused on like that finish line for that morning marathon or that afternoon marathon, and then how the next part of your day would going to go. How much of it is keeping that in mind versus distracting yourself or thinking about other things as you're running? What's kind of your thought process during these times?
Man, so I did have an iPod, and my kids helped me. They were both teenagers at the time, and so I had about 1,500 songs, and I mean everything from, you know, Johnny Cash to Eminem. Like, it was a very eclectic mix, you know, Linkin Park and Alison Krauss and, you know, you name it, it was on this thing, and I loved it. One of my rules for, you know, running was that I wasn't allowed to fast forward through songs. You know, I was out there for so long every day, you know, 12 hours a day, and I wasn't listening to it all the time, but I my joke was that the universe was picking these songs, and whatever came up is what I was supposed to be listening to. So yes, I did use music. I also took about half a dozen or so books on tape that I listened to out there. But I will freely admit it's people talk about boredom when they're running or whatever. And my mind clears, but it also has a tendency to go back in time. And so, you know, I replayed entire arguments with my father. I relived relationships with old girlfriends. It was a time to really be able to reflect and think about, you know, my life and to feel, I guess not only feel the moment that I was in, but also experience, you know, some of the things I'd been through in the past. I will say this. I mean, for people that start a running program, like these days, I don't really listen to music all that much anymore, but I do listen to podcasts just mm-hmm. like this one. And I think that it's become very mainstream, and I highly recommend it for people to, you know, during their workouts, you know, listen to motivational things, listen to podcasts that you like, listen to books. I love to listen to books when I run. 12 hours a day out there across the Sahara was mind-numbingly tedious at times. Mm-hmm. And I don't even want to begin to pretend like there were times when I wanted to just scream from being, you know, bored. But I was in this gorgeous place doing this amazing thing, and I did have, you know, I did have bigger causes attached to it. And there were times when, thanks to being sober so long, I will say I never lose sight of how lucky I am to be doing anything. You know, one of those bullets that hit my car back in Wichita in 1992 easily could have, you know, hit my head instead, and that would have been the end of it.
Mm-hmm. So let me switch gears just a little bit. So you've done a whole bunch of other races. So with the Sahara, there wasn't really as much of a time limit. So what about a race where, like, you're going for the win and there's stiff competition? So it's not really about distracting yourself in the moment, but what do you do in that moment? What do you think about that helps you, like, dig deeper, push a little bit harder to go faster?
Well, I'm certainly a motivated competitor. You know, part of the reason I'm able, I think, to be competitive even into my 50s is, you know, I do take good care of my body, and I also let go of the result. And I'm not really answering your question, but I don't put too much, you know, I still win races and I still get my butt kicked in races, and I don't take either one of them too seriously. I recognize that, you know, anybody who ever watches Running the Sahara, the film that was, you know, that Matt Damon produced, will actually notice that the running only makes up a very small portion of the film. Mm-hmm. Because who the hell wants to watch me run for 12 hours a day? I certainly don't want to.
Yep.
And so, you know, and I wasn't competing out there. So in a race, I don't know, I am motivated by human nature. I'm motivated by watching other people and how they move. And there's a lot of strategy and I guess even some gamesmanship. You know, you always want to look good even when you feel bad. And part of it is sucking it up and just showing your competition that you're stronger than they are. I mean, there's so many strategies in these long races that I do. A marathon is one thing. And look, I'm not an elite marathon runner. You know, I broke 3 hours a whole lot of times, but, you know, I wasn't running, you know, 2:08 with the Kenyans. And so it's not like I was going to win the Boston Marathon or anything. So competition in a race like a marathon for me has always been competition against the clock and not really other people.
Mm-hmm.
In ultras, that changed. And I found that the longer the race was, here's the other thing mentally, and I think you will relate to this and maybe some of your listeners will. I want bad conditions. Like, that's what I tell myself, and I do genuinely believe that to be the truth. I want it to rain. I want it to be cold. I want it to be 140 degrees. Because my view is the harder the conditions, the better I'm going to do in the race. Because I do genuinely believe that I can withstand the punishment, whatever it is, better than other people. You know, I get my tail kicked all the time in hard races by people who are just more talented than I am.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like that always wins the day. But, you know, I think that's the attitude I go into it with, is that I'm going to end up being there. If it's a 100-mile race, I know not to panic if I'm in you know, 30th place at 50 miles, because it's the last 50 miles that really counts. First 50 miles doesn't get you anything, but halfway through.
Mm-hmm. Would you say you have a greater capacity for pain than most people, and is that just some of your inborn talent versus training?
It is. I do actually think that I can withstand pain, but here's the thing, again, because pain is such a weird and abstract concept. You know, my pain compared to your pain, we can't relate the two. Mm-hmm. You know, not really. But what we believe is what is, right? You believe, I mean, I've seen you do things that seem impossible to me. And you clearly believe and know, you know that you can do it. And probably sometimes you know you can do it and maybe you fail.
Mm-hmm.
But your mental, approach to it is, I'm doing this. And that's the way I approach things. You know, I do believe that my life experiences, especially through my years of addiction, prepared me for difficult situations. And it's just, man, running and sports and all that, even family and business, those are all bonuses for me, because I look at this as I'm lucky just to be here.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to leave. How's that old saying go, that old joke about, I don't want to leave a pretty corpse.
Yeah.
I want to be worn down and, maybe not broken apart, but, I want to make sure that I've used all that I have before I'm done, and that I've experienced things. I'll also tell you one other thing that sport does for me. And I think this is, hopefully self-evident in the projects that I take on. I love other cultures. I run in a whole lot of other countries, and there's nothing so wonderful than to run through some village in Africa or in China or someplace where they've never seen anybody that looks like me, and to just have that experience and being on foot in place in other parts of the world puts me on equal ground, no pun intended, with the locals, with the people that are there. And man, I love that feeling.
Mm-hmm.
So I usually won't pick I don't do a whole lot of local races. I'll do some, but I want to go places that I haven't seen before and have an experience that's both cultural and athletic.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Yeah, probably not much of a better way to see the world like that. Well, we're coming up on time, so two final questions. Did you want to mention your next big project? And for people that have enjoyed this and want to connect with you more, where should they follow you? Where should they go?
Yeah, great questions, and absolutely. So my joke is my wife calls it my next bad idea.
Yep.
In a year from now, starting in the beginning of 2019, I'm going to do a human-powered expedition from the lowest place on Earth, which is the Dead Sea, to the highest place on Earth, which, of course, is the top of Mount Everest. And it's about 5,000 miles, and I'm going to swim and run and bike and paddle and sail and mountain bike and climb from the Dead Sea to Mount Everest. And it's going to take about 4.5 months. And I've just done a deal with a company called Oath, which is basically Verizon. And they have come on board this thing, and we are going to do a series that's going to be the first of its kind, a mobile-only release of a series of basically shows that will highlight this expedition. And look, it's a metaphor, I think, for all of our lives. We all struggle from our low places when we hit those to try to get back up to our high points and to the better life that we want to live. So anybody that wants to follow that, I'm all over social media. So all the normal Facebook and Instagram and and all of that. And then my website is, my website's probably the best place. So if you want to, you know, my book is available through Amazon and Barnes & Noble and all the indie bookstores. And but my website is just charlieengel.com. And that's the place you can see my blogs, you can see videos, you can also see my contact info. You know, my phone number and my email are right there on the contact, and it comes directly to me. So, you know, for people out there, if anybody wants to talk about addiction or talk about running or this Dead Sea to Everest, if anybody wants to toss in a couple million dollars, feel free to. you know, but it's going to be a great project, and I'm excited about, you know, doing something. I've done some mountaineering, but, you know, Everest is a whole new ball of wax for me. And so, you know, thanks for letting me mention that. And hopefully I'll write another book about that experience and get a chance to tell that story.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I had a lot of fun today. I definitely learned a few things, and I know people are going to be inspired by your stories, as they always are, and also hopefully learn a few things that can help them to get more comfortable with being uncomfortable.
Man, thank you so much for having me. It was really it was a great conversation, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And you know, I'll come back anytime. Maybe after this next undertaking, we can talk about it again.
Or maybe during. That'd be good.
Absolutely, man. Well, you might be out there next to me just talking. So I'm planning on trying to make you come out for part of it. So.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Charlie.
All right, Logan. I'll talk to you later, buddy. Yeah.